And I said, will come for us all.
Hello, I'm Montana.
And I'm Samantha.
And you're listening to
Reaper Tales. And today I'm going to continue to tell Montana about Judy Buenoano. But first, Montana, what are we supposed to be drinking?
Well, I don't remember. It was a Black Widow thing.
Listen to the first episode and get the recipe. Or just do what we're doing and get seltzers.
get some seltzers. Sorry. We just recorded the first one and I'm like, I don't know.
I don't remember. So, that was an hour ago.
Something about a Black Widow. Also, we forgot to put in a mocktail on the first one. I guess just take the tequila out.
Basically,
that's the only alcoholic thing in there.
Sub the tequila for some Sprite Zero. There you go.
Yeah, that's my go-to for a mocktail.
It works.
Love me a good mocktail.
Mm-hmm. Or you can always do club soda or tonic.
God, whatever I'm not your poison. That fancy. Get out of here.
No, get but you here. Always have limes and lemons at the house so that you can get juice instead of actually doing like I do and just getting the thing of juice. So it's a cheat.
I know. But I use lemons a lot in like cooking. And actually, I got fresh limes this week, not for cocktails, but I'm going to make pad thai.
Fancy.
So I know.
I can't make it because of the fish sauce. Nobody can tolerate the smell.
Oh, I fucking love fish sauce.
It's really good, but the smell's pretty bad.
It is. Whatever.
It's worth it. They all right. Are you ready for us to hopefully finish out the rest of this case?
Yeah, I'm on board. This one's the one that's going to come out on my birthday.
Oh,
Or the day after. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. One day it'll land on my birthday.
But on the bright side, I'm gifting you a day off. So.
Thanks.
I do what I can. So if you haven't listened to part one, you should probably listen to part one because that's going to be everything leading up to this part. We're not going to do like a review. Sorry, not going to do it.
It doesn't matter what we say. We'll always have more downloads on the second part than we do on the first one.
Well, you know, to each his own, but you might be a little lost, but you could probably handle it. I don't know. We'll see. I don't like doing that personally. I don't like only knowing half the story, but to each his own. In any case, moving on to the next victim. Again, from the book Bodies of Evidence, in Michael's medical file, Michael being the oldest child. Quote, Private Second Class Michael B. Goodyear was admitted to the Walter Reed Army Medical Center on January 23, 1980, with a chief complaint of paresthesia and weakness. This 18-year-old right-handed male developed numbness and tingling of all four extremities distally around November 1979. Within 6 weeks, his weakness had progressed such that the patient could no longer walk or use his hands. In addition, his total body weight decreased from 167 pounds in April of 1979 to 123 pounds in January of 1980.
And he's how old at this point?
18.
17? 18? Okay.
According to his mother, the patient has a long history of pica dating to early childhood. He has eaten dirt, licked storage batteries, and eaten a great deal of paint off a wooden house built prior to 1920. Kelsey, can you do me a quick favor and check to see what the issues were with paint on a wooden house built prior to 1920? I'm sure it's going to be the lead.
You don't need to. It was lead.
It's probably lead. I'll look it up
anyway.
Well,
I know it's probably lead, but I feel like it was even a problem after 1920. So why is it specific? Because I feel like even in the 70s, they were still having lead in paint. But I thought about that and I forgot to research it. So blame me for being lazy.
No, I thought that they discontinued lead in paint in the 1930s.
No, I'm pretty sure I still had lead paint on my walls in my old house. And that was built in 1956. So
really?
Could be wrong. Asbestos was also a problem at some point for a while.
Okay. No, you're right. Lead-based paints in homes in the United States they banned it in 1978.
That's what I thought. What was the deal with 1920? Because she specified for a reason that it was built prior to 1920. So I just found that odd and I forgot to look at it.
It might have been just the likelihood that lead showed up.
I mean, they weren't even banning it by this time. Well, they would have just started banning it. So maybe it was the likelihood.
I'm having trouble finding something like that. Go ahead.
Lead paint was had a widespread usage in colonial days in the 1986. Ben Franklin wrote a letter to a friend warning the health dangers of lead paint. In America, lead paint's usage peaked in the 1920s.
Okay. So that's why. Okay. So,
yeah.
Just very, very, very likely.
I think between 1940s and 1970, it was like a lower usage of lead paint in between those times. So the peak was in the 1920s. But after that, it was like it went from like 9 out of 10 houses using lead paint. And later on, it went down to like, you know, 3 out of 5 or whatever. So it was less likely to have it. I mean, you're still likely to have it, but
so
less
it was
likely.
Like, hey, lead's really toxic and we shouldn't be using this. And they're like, the best I can do is use it a little less.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm not gonna get rid of it, but we'll use it a little less. How about that?
But it wasn't completely banned until the 1970s.
Okay, well, this happened in 1979, so
yeah,
that would have been right.
So
around
homes
that
were prior built, I think it's kind of like a grandfather thing, you know, whatever. What was that episode of This Podcast Will Kill You? They covered lead poisoning, mm-hmm. and they talked about it. Go listen to that podcast; they'll tell you about lead paint.
They're amazing. They go into a lot of detail. I love it.
Ditto.
So. Obviously, she was aware of this, and that's why she mentioned that the house was built prior to 1920. The patient was well when he joined the Army in June of 1979, performing adequately in basic training. He basically joined as soon as he turned 18.
Wait. He joined the military with Pica disorder?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it was documented, and they knew about it, but he was still admitted.
Are we sure he even had that? Okay. All right. Go on.
His MOS was that of water purification specialist, which all I can think of is in the Army now. And it's a bad reference for this because it's a funny movie, but that's basically what they did. They got put into water purification, which is an extremely important job. Like your job is to make sure mm-hmm. the water is clean for people to drink. But it just struck me as interesting that that's the direction he went into.
Also, they're putting him in a position where if he does have this disorder, like, mm-hmm. what is happening?
Wow, you put that together real quick. A lab course was part of his training from October 1st to 26th in 1979. And this laboratory was a 1-pint bottle of sodium arsenate from which 1-ounce vials were decanted for testing purposes. These vials contained 80 milligrams of arsenic. On October 16th, 1979, the patient was acutely exposed to chlorine fumes and was briefly admitted to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, with skin and upper airway irritation. In addition to Pica, the patient has suffered from episodic aneurysis, which is involuntary urination, especially at night, basically wetting the bed. Soldiers can actually develop this due to stress and trauma they experience, as well as unhealthy conditions and lack of supplies. And then obviously children can have it and not grow out of it due to stress and trauma.
Yeah.
So
I'm going to blow up my sister's spot, but it's almost her birthday too. We're twins. She had that growing up, but hers was due to like a smaller bladder. Like her bladder was tiny. So they had to inflate it with a balloon. Happy birthday, Mackenzie.
She appreciates
I hope your bladder's still large.
Also, I haven't mentioned it up to this point, but he was tested. His IQ level was tested, and it was low enough that he wasn't doing well in school, but high enough that he didn't qualify for special aid at the time. So it was between like 85 and 95 when he was tested as a teenager.
Which is still pretty low.
So again, water purification, I feel like you would have to be pretty with it for the type of testing that they're doing. So again, I'm kind of surprised that he was approved for that position.
But also, don't know how the test, I've never done an IQ test. I'm sure I'd blow that bitch out of the water. But,
obviously.
You know, obviously.
But you're not a doctor.
But I don't, knowing the time back then, I don't know that they would fully encompass what an IQ test would fully entail. But I don't fully trust something back then to fully encompass what intelligence is.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, even now, to be perfectly honest, still yeah. not necessarily.
Because you don't have to be book smart to be intelligent.
No. It was reported by his sister and brother, which I'm not even going to get in on that unless you open that door. But they also reported that there were some intelligence issues that they noticed, and that he had some attitude issues growing up, and that he got in trouble a lot. He got into things a lot. And because this was all obviously questioned later, if I'm bringing him up, there's an obvious reason for it. And he's in the hospital. Yeah. So as a child, he had frequent upper respiratory infections and questionable history for childhood asthma. In 1975, he suffered a broken nose with subsequent rhinoplasty. He denies tobacco, alcohol, or medicine usage. Mother states his father was killed in Vietnam with unknown medical history. Huh?
No.
When he was born, if it was the one that she was with when he was born, Vietnam wasn't going on. And if it's the one that was his adopted dad, he was back for 3 months before he died.
Yeah.
So no, here we go with that imaginative brain mama got. Mother is alive and well at 36, two teenage siblings both alive and well. The patient went through basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, from June to October 1979, during his transition to Fort Benning, Georgia, en route to which he visited his mother. By the way, that's not on the way. That's a good bit out of it, but okay. He visited his mother in Gulf Breeze, Florida. The patient began having symptoms of
parentheses?
I mean, that's what it says on there, but that's definitely, it definitely auto-corrected what I wrote in there.
It's like, I suffer from that too. I have to take them out of every email.
Oh, removing them can be quite interesting.
Yeah.
Paralysis, I believe, is what it's supposed to be. He reported
that seems better. I mean, it's worse, but also it seems more reasonable.
In this situation, yes. I don't think I would go to the doctor for the other one. He reported to Fort Benning.
I'm sorry. I'm going to keep interrupting. I find it really wild that, and I know that this is, I couldn't imagine having an 18-year-old right now. It's like, holy shit. She's my age.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's true. Yeah. Let me tell you. What? Let me tell you. It's not. It's a trip.
Samantha, tell me how it is.
Okay. I'll give you that much. It's a trip. He reported to Fort Benning on, well, I mean, she does, but she doesn't, because he's not like living with her. He turned 18 and like a second later joined the army. So, but anyway, he reported to Fort Benning on November 6, 1979. Neurological examination on that date was within normal limits, except for a slight decrease in distal perception of primary sensory modalities. On November 13th, 1979, the patient checked himself into the base hospital with nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and numbness of extremities. The patient stated he had experienced these symptoms since November 1st, 1979. By November 16th, the patient's muscle paralysis was clinically apparent, primarily distal and symmetrically involving all four extremities. At that time, his weight was 149 pounds, and white transverse lines were noted on all fingernails. He was admitted to Martin Army Hospital to rule out a peripheral neuropathy, which was initially thought to be a functional etiology. Urine toxic drug screen was normal. So they did a toxic drug screen, but it was a toxic drug screen, not.
Yeah, they're checking for like weed or
any or pharmaceutical drugs, any of that.
Aren't the white lines on fingernails, isn't that like a calcium deficiency?
Can be, yeah.
Which didn't the last guy that she killed, he had a calcium deficiency?
Yep. Good catch.
Interesting.
By mid-December 1979, the patient had developed leukopenia, which is a reduction in white blood cell count, and mild anemia. Peripheral neuropathy was confirmed by nerve conduction velocity studies, with both motor and sensory being significantly impaired. Serum lead level was elevated at 57, normal is less than 45, as was urine lead level at 140, normal is less than 80. Lead toxicity was also suggested by elevated urine porphyrins, which is a specific compound that in high levels can cause major problems, mainly in the nervous system and skin.
So is this supposed to be like lead poisoning, not arsenic poisoning?
We're not there yet.
Oh, okay.
On January 7th, 1980, serum arsenic was normal, less than 10, while urine values were elevated at greater than 250, and the normal range is between 0 and 100. Yeah. So more than double.
So arsenic. Yeah.
The patient was given a course of chelation therapy. According to the Mayo Clinic, chelation therapy uses special drugs that bind to metals in your blood. You get the chelating medicine through IV, an IV tube in your arm, and it's also available in pill form. Once the drug has attached to the metal, your body removes them through your urine. So that's basically how they clear your body of harmful, toxic metals in your system. Iron is supposed to be in your body, but the way arsenic works and how it can cause problems can directly relate to also causing iron to be toxic in your body because you hold in so much.
Okay. But then after that treatment, wouldn't you be iron deficient?
They're replenishing anything that you need at that same time, but they have to get the toxic levels down. And he was toxic in the iron anyway, so he had to get the toxic level. I mean, he had to get it down to a not toxic level. And obviously had to get all that arsenic out. And I'm assuming the serum test is like testing it from your blood. That's my guess.
Gotcha. What it must be like to have enough iron in your body.
Right? No anemia. Which is interesting, right? Because the previous person was anemic, which is a lack of iron in your blood. So, but I think it had to do with him being around certain chemicals and compounds with what he was doing in the army that caused this.
Right.
The combination of the two.
A mix between arsenic and probably like lead and shit like that that they find. Just in his day-to-day work.
Possibly.
Interesting.
That's the theory.
Okay.
So he went through this therapy from January 9th until the 17th. By January 16th, his weight had decreased to 123 pounds. On January 23rd, 1980, the patient was transferred to the neurology service at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Upon admission, his vital signs were stable.
What, how tall was he?
I never got a height. But okay. I mean, regardless.
123.
That's low.
123 is small. I mean, I doubt he's my height.
Well, I mean, when he came in, he was less than 170.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
So, I mean, he was small pounds? To begin with.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tiny.
So upon admission, his vital signs were stable. There was generalized muscle wasting and atrophy. You don't say. At 123 pounds, I would imagine so. Key. Mies lines were present on all fingernails measuring 10 millimeters from the cuticle. So yet another evident thing to look for. Hair arsenic level was 7 times the normal value.
Jesus. Wait, if it's in his hair, she's been doing this a long time.
Not necessarily. It depends on how far up the hair they tested.
Okay.
Because your hair, that's how they have to look at it. If they test it near the scalp, then that's going to be within the last month or two. Like there's so many inches that they roughly measure out to determine how long you've had it in your system. And it didn't specify in this how far up they tested that hair. I'm guessing they probably just took the follicle and tested it because they were just trying to kind of weigh how heavy this was affecting him. Like how much did you have in your system and what kind of treatment should we be giving you? Essentially. Gotcha. Because at this point, they don't think there's anything. They're not assuming foul play at this point because of what he did for the army.
Yeah. They think
they're trying to lessen their possible guilt, but they're not assuming anything to do with his mom.
Yeah. They're trying to prove they're not culpable. Gotcha.
Yeah, basically. Approximate retrograde dating would place arsenic exposure around mid-October 1979. That's literally what I told you. So they're looking at the hair and they're going off of how fast your hair grows. And everybody's hair grows at a different level and how quickly it grows. So usually the rule is like between a quarter of an inch and a half an inch for most people is about what it grows in around a month. Now, if you're sick, your hair's not going to grow as much. If your body is fighting off infection or toxins, it's not going to grow as much. So this is not a exact science by any means whatsoever. So to say around mid-October, they're solving for, or they're basically solving an equation for the answer that they already have in front of them, I feel like, personally.
Right. Okay.
So around mid-October 1979, coincidental with his laboratory course in water purification school. How about that? Vibration, position, touch, pain, and temperature perception were absent distal to the elbow and distal to the knee. So that means that he could not feel anything from the elbow down and from the knee down.
Yikes.
On either of his legs.
Okay.
Psychological testing was normal with verbal IQ of 92 without evidence of thought disorder or serious intellectual deficits. And this was just to kind of gauge his cognitive abilities. The patient was vigorously trained in occupational and physical therapy. The patient intermittently became depressed, no kidding, owning to poor self-imaging and fear of never walking again. He has shown good improvement with the use of leg braces and physical therapy, allowing for an improved outlook toward his future. His concern toward lack of ability to have an erection was addressed by psychotherapy. His serum and urine levels of both lead and arsenic failed to rise significantly. However, a second Mies line did become apparent in subsequent weeks. The patient can feed himself by use of a Robin's hook prosthesis. Dressing and toilet care are not independent. The patient requires a wheelchair. With continued long-term physical therapy, the patient may regain some degree of independent ambulation. His condition is static and not expected to change for the better or for the worse.
I know what this one is. I know what this case is now.
Okay.
I've heard it. Okay. Took me long enough.
Yeah, we got quite a bit down. So this is one of the few opportunities to look at a case that they actually caught the reason and were able to treat for the poisoning. But unfortunately, the damage had been done and it was largely irreversible. He was going to require help for the rest of his life at the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
19 yeah. by the time he got out of the hospital. According to bodies of evidence, quote, the diagnosis of Michael Goodyear included peripheral neuropathy with motor and sensory components, secondary to lead and arsenic toxicity, lead ingestion, possibly chronic, and arsenic ingestion, probably acute, in mid-October 1979, probably secondary to his habit of eating non-food substances. The medical report concluded that Private Goodyear was unfit for further military duty and recommended that he be transferred to a VA spinal cord rehabilitation center, preferably near his mother's home in northern Florida, for further training in physical therapy, end quote.
What's crazy to me is when I've heard this previously, I didn't hear about all the other stuff that you've covered. So
I was surprised that a lot of the cases are like 30 minutes long. When yeah, I saw him on podcast, I'm like, you are missing a lot of stuff.
They mostly just go over what happens to him.
Well, it was a big part of the case, but don't sit here and try to make guesses. So apparently his stepdad, Bobby Joe, the one that had most recently passed away, had worked in water purification as well. So it's possible that at least part of that was what pushed Michael to pursue that same field in the Army. However, it would also explain that maybe Mama pushed him to do that because she would have known because of Bobby Joe's experience that they deal with arsenic.
Oh.
And true. Apparently Michael was trying to do everything he could to win the love of his mother his entire life.
Mm. Honey, it ain't happening.
So it would not have been hard for him, for her to push him to do something he didn't want to do and to put him in harm's way in doing that. Just saying. That is allegedly, not that it matters, because she's no longer alive. Spoiler alert.
Oh, no.
I don't feel bad for her at all. Quote, the medical reports further revealed that in March 1980, Private Michael B. Goodyear was transferred to the VA hospital in Tampa, Florida, pending medical treatment for permanent disability. On May 12th, 1980, he was discharged into his mother's care at her home in Gulf Breeze, Florida. On May 13th, 1980, one day later, Michael Buenoano Goodyear drowned when his canoe with his mother and brother aboard overturned at approximately 3:30 p.m. on the East River, about 1/2 mile east of Highway 87 Bridge near Milton, Florida. There was an Army casualty report. It said, and I quote, at the time of the accident, PV2 Goodyear was wearing full leg braces and a device on his right arm, which operated a prosthetic hand through cables and braces with the muscles of his right shoulder. His attending physician stated that PV2 Goodyear was completely immobile from the knees and elbows down. He could not walk, even with braces, and had no control with his arms. He further stated it would have been impossible for the boy to swim with or without braces, even with a life vest. His mother recovered his brother and swam a quarter mile, where they were picked up by a fellow boater. PV2 Goodyear's body was recovered 4 or 5 hours later by Santa Rosa search and rescue divers. The assistant medical examiner stated that no alcohol or drugs were involved. Preliminary finding was death by drowning. So that was the military casualty report. The autopsy report on Michael Buenoano Goodyear concluded, quote, the findings are consistent with a severe peripheral neuropathy. Numerous agents are capable of causing this, and findings were compatible with a clinical history of exposure to heavy metals. The findings of the remainder of autopsy were unremarkable, except for the presence of a marked hemorrhagic pulmonary edema typical of drowning. Final pathological diagnosis, peripheral neuropathy, atrophy of muscles, and congestion and pulmonary edema of lungs caused by drowning.
Okay, I'm real curious. Would you put your loved one in a boat that had like weighted braces and metal gear on them, especially a canoe of all things, and put it out into the middle of water? I'm going to guess he didn't have a life vest, but even if he did, the weight of that gear on him and the weight that he is, around 120 pounds, is going to weigh him down even more. Like, why would you risk that? Why on earth?
Excellent question.
So, I mean, I would look at something like that and be like, you're a fucking idiot.
I mean, at the very least, you're negligent. Mm-hmm. Bare minimum.
At the very least. Yeah. Let me guess. There was a life insurance policy on him.
How'd you know? Hey. After Michael's death, Judy collected $125,000 in military life insurance benefits for her son's death. It was later found that the policies had been signed by Michael. At times, he was not even present, as he'd been serving in the military or in a different city and or state on the specific dates. When the insurance companies were asked how it was possible and or if they evaluated Michael's health, they claimed they assumed the parents knew what was best for their children, etc. So basically, wasn't my fault.
Sure.
Okay. So, I'm going to go back to that later. The last person in her life to be mentioned is, as always, the one that got people looking her way and feeling particularly suspicious. In June 1983... Judy was out at a restaurant with her then-fiancé, John Gentry. They had arrived in separate cars, and John was ready to leave, and they had planned to meet up at home later. Do you know this part?
No, I don't remember this part.
Oh, my gosh. John went out to his car, turned the ignition, and shortly after, the car exploded.
Oh, yep.
John was miraculously spared, and he was able to exit the vehicle, noticing that his shoes had been blown off his feet. Like, when you're in a traumatic experience like that, you notice some of the weirdest things later and report them.
It was a casino moment. If you guys haven't seen Casino, Robert De Niro and all of that whole cast in it, in the beginning credits or the beginning intro to the Casino movie, and that's kind of where it ends too, Robert De Niro's character is getting in his car and his car blows up, but there is a metal plate that is under the driver's side of the car that actually saves his life. It just blows her shoes off. So I wonder if Casino took a note from this lady.
Oh yeah, because that would have been that. After this. I don't know. It could have been.
Yeah. What a great movie.
I'll put it on my list. He said he felt like he was back in Vietnam when he had stepped on a landmine. Of course, he had no idea how or why this thing had happened to him. He immediately worried about Judy, who had just told him that day that she was pregnant. He attempted to walk to the restaurant, but collapsed on the sidewalk. He was still able to look around him and remembered seeing Judy standing over him, screaming hysterically before fainting.
What a drama queen.
Right? Well, she's pregnant after all. Later on, it was revealed that she had had a hysterectomy quite a while before this. So yeah, that was a complete lie.
God, she just never stops.
Yeah, it was
just everything like, in her life. It's
I mean, every time I turned something else in this book, I was like, you have got to be kidding me. This is the most ridiculous shit. Like, I would just throw my, I looked exactly like Kelsey did just a second ago of like, oh my God, really?
Yeah, that's insane.
Tell me another one,
Judy.
She
didn't outsmart him that time.
No, this is actually where
she didn't know.
She, okay, so in this one, she also involved her son, James, and had James install everything. So he was involved, but he ended up coming out clean. They let him go, but he was involved in this one.
Yeah, he's a kid.
I think he was 18, so technically he was an adult, but they kind of, they were like, boy, you grew up with this lady. Like, you've been punished enough.
Yeah. We'll cut you some slack. Was he involved with Michael's death?
He was in the canoe with his mom.
Yeah.
And Michael, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That boy's been through some trauma. And Kimberly, honestly. But I feel like she was a little less involved than James was. From everything that I read and saw, he was like mama's boy. And to a level that was concerning.
Bates Motel?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
John reports Kelsey's later, the fiance reports later that he saw some things that looking back after this was like, yeah, that was not normal and definitely not a not something that should be going on. After the police were able to see the damage to the car and investigate the cause, they reported, quote, two sticks of dynamite in the trunk under the left back seat. It was rigged pretty good. The wires were connected to the tail lights, so it wouldn't go off until after dark. We thought at first it was hooked to the ignition. Since he was long-legged and short-bodied, he must have leaned forward to turn on the ignition and the lights at the same time. That might have saved his life. A 2-inch piece of shrapnel went right through the headrest, shot through two layers of sheet metal, and lodged into the frame of the sunroof. If he'd been leaning back, it would have gone straight through the back of his skull.
Oh, yikes.
The word's already out on the street that it was some king of mafia drug deal, anything for a headline, end quote. The reason why it was a mafia drug deal rumor going along is, take a wild guess, why?
I'm guessing his lovely fiance said he was involved with the mob.
Well, she's like, obviously, that's what's going on here. However, oh, it was deemed an amateur job, so they quickly ruled out the mafia hit.
They're like, the mob's smarter than this. Bitch.
Exactly. He only had a small amount of weed on him, so again, not likely. And come to find out later, that was planted on him. He did not realize that that was even in his pocket, because when they mentioned it, he was like, what?
Who didn't have a small amount of weed on him?
Well, and that's what, like, when they said that in the book and the investigator heard that, he's like, okay, so this is a guy that's a business guy. He went out to a restaurant with his wife and he smokes a little bit of weed. Like,
Okay.
This does not strike me as obvious mafia like situation here.
Like, who doesn't smoke a little bit of weed?
Especially back then. The police felt if it had been a professional, they would have connected the dynamite to the gas tank to make sure the job would be successful.
Yeah, right.
Which, fair. They would know what they're doing. They would not want him to be alive to tell the tale. There were two pieces of multi-strand wire left that seemed to be used to connect the leg wires of the blasting cap to the taillights, along with some fragments from the blasting cap, some black electrician's tape, and residue from the explosives. Luckily, the wires were not a common type of wire. They were actually some kind of color-coded type typically used by auto manufacturers, which is what ended up sealing the deal, because they were able to track that and figure out where it was purchased. And then later on, spoiler alert, they look through the house and find the rest of the wires. Well, they find an exact same wire in a closet in Judy's home. But they, of course, can't prove that the wires used were specifically cut from this roll, because there's not a way to do that. But it was the exact same wire. So, I mean, okay, come on. And it's not a common wire used. So, all right, whatever.
Right.
The police then visited John Gentry at Sacred Heart Hotel, where he had been taken after the bombing. At this point, it was discussed that despite the fact that it wasn't a good part of town, Judy had parked her white Corvette almost two blocks away from the restaurant, which at the very least seemed very suspicious.
Yeah. I ain't walking.
It was also in a bad side of town.
Yeah. doesn't matter. I ain't walking. Good side of town, bad side of town.
So who's going to be walking when they're pregnant? Nobody. Not that she actually was. Anyway.
No.
The medical report for Gentry, quote, read like that of a wartime casualty. Multiple fragment wounds secondary to a blast injury. X-rays revealed multiple metal fragments contained within the posterior chest, flank, and scalp. Some secondary to fragment wounds sustained by the patient while in Vietnam. There were multiple large fragment wounds of the right flank with intra-abdominal penetration. The wounds were found to contain large metallic fragments measuring up to 7 to 8 centimeters in diameter, which is pretty significant considering.
That's pretty big.
As well as multiple fragments of foam, rubber, plastic, and cloth. There were lacerations of the posterior scalp measuring 6 centimeters in length and a laceration of the left posterior ear containing a metallic fragment. The entire right colon had been severed by a metallic fragment contained within the abdominal cavity.
Oh,
yeah. The same fragment. And you know that's not fun to fix.
Mm-mm.
The same fragment passed through the lower pole of the lower pole, which was weird, but I guess it's a term, of the right kidney and lacerated the lower lateral third of the kidney. The wounding fragment also lacerated the right transverse mesocolon as it passed through the abdominal cavity. So there was a lot of abdominal issues, obviously. They had to go in and clean all of the metal fragments that they found, which later on, he says that there are fragments that are left there that they just couldn't get out and they were just always going to be in his body and at any point in time could kill him. So that's fun.
Oh, great.
Which is, it's not uncommon. It's a little less common now, I think, but that was frequently the case. Like, to take it out would have caused more damage than it would have fixed. So they would have to just leave it there. So that's fine.
Yeah.
Estimated blood loss was 1,500 cc's and the patient received 1,000 cc's replacement. For reference, loss of 1,500 to 2,000 cc's is about a half a gallon of blood.
Yikes.
At that point, your blood pressure drops, your limbs are cold and clammy, your skin is pale, you may become confused or flustered. The patient tolerated the operation well and was returned to the intensive care unit, which was important because he needed to be interviewed badly.
Right.
When they were able to talk to John on June 29th, 1983, it was 4 days after the car bombing, which I'm kind of surprised it was that fast, but I guess they got him stabilized fast enough. They asked the standard questions. Do you know of anybody who would want you dead or may benefit from your death? Judy had named someone more than once, Jackie Morgan, but John dismissed that quickly, that she wouldn't have wanted him dead. Jackie Morgan, she mentioned, it was like they had a bad business deal and she had lost a lot of money and she was trying to pursue John for like lawsuit purposes, although he didn't really have any money for her to take from him. So he was like, yeah, okay, sure. She wants my money, but she's not going to want me dead. That really wouldn't benefit her at all. Then when they asked him about insurance policies that he might have out, John remembered he and Judy had signed paperwork for insurance policies on each other to cover them in the event that they died so that the other could purchase the business and have the funds to run it if needed. See, Judy had a business named Fingers and Faces, which was a nail salon and spa type place.
Oh, man.
This lady's apparently a nurse. She's had a daycare center and now she's running a salon. Okay.
I remember this from, I think it was Wine and Crime that did it. And I think they named the episode Fingers and Faces.
I mean, it's the most ridiculous name I've ever heard for, I mean,
Fingers and
I
faces.
Guess it makes sense, but also that did not age well. I'll put it that way. And John also had his own business, Wallpaper Mill Outlet, which was a discount carpet and wallpaper store. When asked how much the policy was for, he responded, $500,000 a piece.
Yikes.
So this is the transcript from that conversation after that point. Whoa, that's a lot of money. You're not even married to her. Well, Judy and I were planning on getting married, and whenever you have two businesses, you want to make sure that if something happens, it's taken care of. So we went down and saw Barbara, my insurance agent. Gentry coughed and looked away. The thing is, we had to tell the insurance company some things that weren't quite true. We had to say that we had an insurable interest in each other's business so that if one of us were to die, the other would need insurance to cover their losses. The insurance agent wrote a covering letter to that effect because we weren't married, and the insurance company accepted it. When did the policy go into effect? We applied sometime in late October or early November. We were talking about $50,000. I figured that was enough to take care of whatever debts would be left over and to be buried. She wanted to up it to $100,000. I said, okay, that's reasonable, and we left. I asked Judy about it on a couple of occasions, and at one point she said the insurance company wasn't acting fast enough, and she went there and told them to cancel it. That was fine by me. But the other day, Friday I think it was, I called the insurance agency about something else with my business, and I asked them about the policy, how come Judy didn't like it. They told me not only did she like it, she upped it to $500,000.
Oh my.
It'd been in effect since last November, so I guess Judy never did cancel it. I just let it ride. Who cares about something like that? This man.
I would.
This man.
Sir.
God bless him.
Sir.
Oh, okay. That would not have worked on me. Needless to say, this interaction didn't just get the detective's attention and make them suspicious. It also made Gentry think, did she want him dead? Was she really pregnant? What else had she lied to him about? So we talked to Judy about how he wanted to do his rehab at his mother's instead of her home, and she flew into a rage.
You don't say.
Well, that's going to say bye-bye to any option of possibly killing him in the future.
Right? It's pretty apparent, my guy, that she doesn't want you around.
The next day, he decided to bring up something else that had seemed odd. At some point, Judy had encouraged him to take these Vicon C vitamins, but every time he took them, he noticed he would feel sick. Judy would encourage him to take two every day, so he thought maybe he would just take one. He was still getting sick, so he went to the doctor to see what was going on, but they were not able to figure out why that was happening. So he just stopped taking them, storing them in his pockets until he could throw them away later when Judy wouldn't know. But for some reason, he couldn't quite put his thumb on. He just kept a couple and then gave them to the detectives when he told them about them.
That's what's so annoying about this. Like, this guy knew.
He knew something was up.
He knew that something was wrong.
But I don't think he thought she was trying to kill him. I think he just figured that the medicine was making him sick for some reason. And so he was just going to stop taking them. But at the same time, it was like, what is actually in these things that's making me sick? I've taken vitamin C before, and I've never gotten sick like this. So what's the deal with these?
Yeah.
We're about to find out. You don't have to wait like he did for weeks. When the detectives took them to be analyzed, they appeared to be tampered with. Instead of the vitamin C compound, they had an unknown powder, which turned out to be paraformaldehyde, a class 3 poison with, quote, no known medical use. Continued ingestion would cause slow deterioration of the internal organs and eventual death. The substance would not be detected in an autopsy report, end quote.
Mm.
Da, 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 da. So basically, when that didn't work and he stopped taking the medicine and she couldn't figure out why it wasn't working, we'll just blow him up. She got impatient.
She went 90 to nothing. Like, it was just...
That was what drew me to this case. I was like, okay, I've had poisonings before. Oh, well, let's just go to car bombing. That's the obvious next step from poisoning.
She didn't even, like, try something different that was, like, less detectable. You know what? I'm going to make the biggest spectacle out of this. The fuck, lady?
She needed some more money. She was
actually, and that's
what was going on. She was running out of money fast because she was spending. She lived fast and hard. Like, she bought expensive houses. She bought a white Corvette, and she bought that Corvette, by the way, with the money that she got from Michael's insurance. And she put CDs in her children's names so that they couldn't be touched in case debt collectors came around trying to find her. So she was thinking proactively with that. But she had so many debts because she was spending more money than she had that she needed money to start paying some of them off.
That is so wild to me. Like, she had so much money from, like, different life insurance policies. Like, she could have probably comfortably lived if she had spent it well.
The way you should. Maybe for the purposes that it's there.
Right.
No, she deserved the best of everything. And she was going to make sure that happened.
God.
So at the time of the car bombing, Judy was described as a, quote, this is where I told you it's going to be different. White female, 5'6", 130 pounds, dark hair, dark complexion, not very pretty, end quote.
What?
So we went from an attractive female to not very pretty.
Well, at this
I guess
point,
those
she's
years
what?
Were rough. I guess those years were rough on her.
Yeah. Well, she's also in her late 30s. She's lived in Florida most of her life.
Well, the Florida thing would do it.
I don't think that SPF was really a big thing back then.
Definitely not. Definitely not.
So that can age you pretty quickly, so I guess.
You're about to lose your mind.
Oh, good.
Gentry had believed everything that Judy had told him about her education and her profession. Take a wild guess at what she's currently doing and what her education looks like. I'm going to do to you what you do to me.
I'm going to guess that she is a nail tech, or she's like a massage therapist or something like that, that involves like a license. Oh, higher up. She's a nurse practitioner.
Closer.
She's a physician's assistant.
What's her education look like?
She went to classes for her GED.
You're not going
to get
it right, but go for it.
She took a class for a GED, but didn't get her GED.
That's probably accurate. She'd gone to nursing school on a scholarship, had PhDs in biochemistry and psychology from the University of Alabama, and had been the head of nursing at West Florida Hospital.
Honey, no. What are you doing?
She shoots for the moon. Every guy that she meets, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
What's weird is she has these goals and like these aspirations, or these like made up at like achievements and things like that. And she's smart enough that if she actually applied herself instead of like, just fucking killing people to be successful, I think she could have been those things.
Probably. Probably. I mean, Gentry even said she was very well versed in medicines.
Yeah, well, yeah, I would believe that.
He's like, she's always referencing that medical book that she had under her arm.
She's walking around with a medical book under her arm all the time. I am
apparently.
I'm going to start doing that.
Just walk around with a medical book, and when people ask me questions, I have just the book. Find the specific thing.
Meanwhile, everybody's just Googling it.
Well, you could do that. Now, I've gone into a lot of detail up to this point about the victims because I haven't really had an opportunity to do that up to this point with other cases. And I wanted you to see the similarities in some of the symptoms and what the doctors did to try to figure out what was going on with these people, because they really were trying to figure it out. And at that time, arsenic poison just wasn't a thing. Like, they just didn't see it that often. So it wasn't even on their radar unless somebody said something.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on the trials. Like I mentioned in part one, it's a lot of the same stuff. It's,
I can't believe you would think that I would do that. I love them.
Yeah, no, you didn't. You loved money. So I don't go into that, but I'll go into some of the information that was found in the investigation, as well as kind of like the results of everything. So as the detectives started their investigation, they started realizing that the people around her that died kept piling up, which, you know, obviously made them a little bit suspicious. PerpyandJ.com, we worked a lot of hours and we found out things about Judy, that she had been married before, that her husband had died, and it just went on and on and on from there. While we were still working the bomb case too, remembered Chamberlain. Every time we'd look into something, we'd say, this is not right. And then we keep looking and find someone else had died. Then I found out about her son in Santa Rosa County and his accidental drowning. I knew there was a hell of a lot more to it than just a car bombing, end quote. I hate this part. They discovered that the case for Michael, her 18 to 19 year old son, 19 when he passed, was more than suspicious. Not only did he test positive for arsenic poisoning, which they were starting to suspect was what had killed her previous husbands as well, and they knew Gentry had been poisoned, but that the manner of death was insane. What mother would put her son in a canoe when he was weighed down by 15 pounds of braces and would be unable to swim due to the lack of control of his limbs? So they looked into the case further. They then found out that he wasn't even wearing a life vest, but instead a water ski belt, which is not approved for the type of craft that they were in and would in no way, shape, or form have kept Michael afloat. Even a life vest wouldn't have, because of the 15 pounds of braces. There were other parts that didn't make sense that seemed to point to that of the capsizing of the canoe being intentional rather than a tragic accident.
You don't say.
Get ready for the story. Their story was that they, Judy, James, and Michael was sitting in a lawn chair that had been wedged and apparently secured in the middle of the canoe, were fishing in the canoe. Michael was fishing as well with his own pole, something that his doctor said was not possible.
Yeah.
Very definitively. There's no way he could have fished, but okay. When Michael's line got caught in a tree, when they tried to free the line, a snake fell from the tree, startling them. When they tried to deal with that, the canoe hit a log in the water and it capsized, dumping them all in the water.
She's doing too much.
To be clear, this story has developed in each telling. Originally, a snake fell from the tree and startled them, causing it to capsize. Then the line got caught first, which is why the snake dropped, et cetera, et cetera.
You don't even need that. The snake can just drop. It happens all the time.
One of the main rules of a believable story is what?
The fewer details, the better.
Keep it simple, stupid. Because the more complicated, the harder it is to remember each time you tell the story, and the less likely people are going to believe it actually happened that way.
Yeah, and I don't get why they would put him... I'm having a hard time picturing why they would put him in a lawn chair. I had braces on my legs when I was young, and it's a lot easier to sit with them stretched out than it is for you to like sit up like
that.
Which
was mentioned.
So... I don't know.
It was mentioned that it was almost possible for him to bend his legs.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to keep them stretched out than it is anything. Because they're there to help support. So they're very stiff. It's not easy to bend them. You know, I don't know. Also, I was a young child. I had dislocated my hip. So that's the only reason. I didn't have anything super wrong with me. So, yeah, but they're uncomfortable. You want to sit with them stretched out. I don't know. Lawn chair doesn't seem reasonable. Also, I think she just said that so it would seem like, because the weight distribution when it's higher like that would make it easier for the boat to tilt than anything.
Well, and they claimed over and over, her, James, and Kimberly claimed over and over that Michael had wanted to be treated like he was normal and he wanted to do things that he had always loved to do, and like playing sports and fishing and water sports. And then they looked at it and he never did any of those things. None of them.
Yeah.
They couldn't find a single thing in any yearbook or with any of schoolmates that he went to school with that could remember him playing any sports whatsoever, even before any of this happened. So,
not to mention, she tried to drop him off at the Humane Society at one point.
Basically. So, unfortunately, yeah. But that was like the claim, is he wanted to be normal and he wanted to do normal things. So the very next day after he is released to her care, she puts him in a canoe. Okay, sure. We can't fish from a boat that's not going to capsize. We're going to go into a canoe because we've done that before, apparently. Sure.
What did James say about this?
He repeated what his mom said. And it was interesting because in the book they talked about it and they started putting these pieces together. And they did not let her know that they were on to her, and they immediately arrested James and Kimberly without letting her know. They got her last and put them in front of the grand jury before she could get a hold of them, so that when they asked them the questions, they weren't prepared by her prior to that. And their answers were completely different when it came to trial. And so they asked them, so were you lying before or are you lying now? Oh, I didn't remember well. Oh, but you remember well now after you've talked to your mom and your lawyer. But you didn't remember then. That's correct. Okay. So it was like the jury, I mean, they were not going to win this case. Not by a long shot. And they tried to bless Kimberly's heart. I hated it for her because she was still underage. She was crying. She was miserable. You could tell she felt terrible about the whole situation. But she loved her mom. And she didn't want her mom to go to jail. So she was in like an impossible spot. And she was just crying on the stage, just trying to get out of that whole situation. It took her, I think it ended up taking her 2 days to do her testimony.
When you're a kid like that, you think that the only people who can care about you or who will love you are your parents. You don't think that there's another option. And especially if you have a parent that's as manipulative and controlling as her mother was, I wouldn't be surprised if her mother was like, if you ever say anything, they'll just kill
me. Read the book about a narcissistic mother and their daughter's relationships.
I could make the recommendation. I grew up
it is a special relationship and it's specifically toxic. So yeah, not hard to believe at all. But I mean, the whole thing for me is like just leaving it at the snake dropping in the canoe would have been more than enough. Nobody would have even questioned it because I wouldn't. If a snake fell on me while I was in a canoe, yeah, I probably would capsize it because it would have scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
But they just kept
adding
stuff.
That's why I don't go canoeing.
Fair. That's very fair.
Sorry, Daisy, if you're listening to this. I know I said I'd go canoeing. Eventually, I might. Kayaking. She wants me to go kayaking.
Well, she's not going to dump you out of it.
It would just like... Kayaking just, like, is a little better. And, like, yeah.
Not quite the same.
So, I don't know. Maybe.
Well, then, after the detectives talked to the boater who had picked them up, he said that Judy had insisted they go to shore to get help for James and not try to rescue Michael right away. See, James was very injured from the capsizing, and she claimed he had a hairline fracture of the 7th C vertebrae. She was very specific about that, though he was released from the hospital with just a soft neck brace.
Okay.
Sure. In addition, the boater said she asked for one of his beers to drink on the way back to shore, where Kimberly was waiting for them and fishing from the pier.
She got to celebrate somehow.
Later in the trial, the defense claimed she never drank a drop of alcohol, no matter when. Like, even when she went to parties, she would never drink anything. I don't know why they fixated on that, but okay, whatever. The detectives tried to press charges for the poisoning and attempted murder with the bombing of Gentry's car, but the judge said there wasn't sufficient evidence. So they pursued the murder of her son in the canoe accident instead. There was obviously a lot more to the case, but just summing up the above, it was clear she was guilty. There was a lot of sobbing and outrage that they dared accuse her, despite there being more than enough evidence that he seemed to be more of an inconvenience to her than a beloved child. And also, there was obvious different treatment between him and James in a big way. The result of the first trial that ran from March 22nd until the 31st was a conviction, and on June 6, 1984, she was sentenced to life in prison without parole for the first 25 years. On October 15th through the 18th, she was tried for the attempted murder of Gentry, and was also convicted. This time, the jury only took 2 hours to make their decision and sentenced to an additional 12 years in prison. On top of life, I guess. After the first and second convictions brought encouragement to the detectives to exhume the bodies of her previous husband, Goodyear, and her boyfriend, Morris. They tested the remains and found that what no one who has ever heard an episode on this podcast would be surprised to hear, they were positive for arsenic poisoning.
What?
They decided to move forward with another charge and trial for Goodyear only, as there were issues with how the remains were processed, as well as questions about the manner of death for Morris. There was more questions for his death rather than Goodyear's. His was much more straightforward, so they felt like Goodyear was a better case to move forward with.
Which is so shitty because Morris has family.
His mother was very adamant about people looking into the death of her son, and she was all in saying that there was something wrong with that death all the way up until I think she died, which is unfortunate.
That's a really shitty situation. I hate when that happens. And I know that sometimes like law enforcement will not, or the DA's office will not press charges on all of them in case they get off from any of the ones that they're, you know, being convicted from. They still have that in their back pocket. But it still sucks for the family because they want answers. It's not, I'm sure they know what the answers are, but they want closure. There's that closure that you don't get. You know, you can know in your heart of hearts, you can know factually, but until somebody, you know, suffers the consequences of their actions, that still weighs heavy on you. So that sucks for her.
Well, they were also claiming, and the part that was really gross, they claimed that Morris abused James and Kimberly and because he was an alcoholic.
But he wasn't.
But there was no way. It was their word against his, and he was dead. So, and they weren't using the autopsy for some reason to deny that. So I don't really know what the deal was with that, but that was the other reason. It was just kind of too muddy and they didn't want to risk losing another conviction because they were trying to get the death penalty for her. That's why they were piling on as much as they could.
God, what a bitch.
So on October 22nd, 1985, she was tried and convicted a week later for Goodyear's death by poisoning. And on November 16th, 1985, she was sentenced to death. She was also convicted on multiple counts of grand theft for the multiple cases of insurance fraud, obviously. And there were even thoughts that she had committed arson as more than one of her houses burned to the ground, but she wasn't convicted.
You don't say.
You don't say.
It's shocking.
She was granted a stay of execution by a federal court in June of 1990, but ultimately the conviction and sentence were upheld on March 27, 1998. Judy Buenoano was executed March 30th, 1998, so 3 days later, by electric chair, making her the first woman to be executed in Florida since 1848 and the third woman executed in the United States since the reinstatement of the death penalty in 1976.
I don't have any comment on that.
A quick note from earlier in 1998. Quote, two executions in the chair, including one last year, resulted in fires, and state officials were forced to examine whether using it was cruel and unusual punishment. Florida's governor, Lawton Chiles, signed a bill continuing its use and adding the provision that if courts ever rule use of the chair unconstitutional, lethal injection would be the state's designated backup, end quote. Yeah, literally, the people caught fire.
Yeah, that's not cool.
Because there was something wrong with the current. Because I read there was at least one case of that.
I have a real, I mean, everybody knows what my opinion is on the death penalty. I don't believe in it. And even with somebody as bad as she is, she's going to, if she gets a life sentence, she's going to be in prison the rest of her life where she's not going to have access to arsenic or bombs to kill anybody. So there's no point in doing this. So I have a really, a good riddance, whatever. But at the same time, I just don't think that that is a great choice. Especially if people are catching on fire. That seems, you know, not okay.
Yeah, because anytime that happens, it obviously takes a lot longer for the execution because something has gone wrong and you can't stop it in the middle of it. Like you literally can't.
So you have to keep going.
You're thinking, if you want to know what I'm talking about, watch The Green Mile. That's basically what was happening. Yeah. The voltage wasn't high enough, but it was high enough to catch them on fire. That's a problem. That definitely should be unconstitutional. That's definitely torture. That's not humane in any way, shape, or form. And if you can't figure out a way to do it effectively every single time, or if there's a possibility that it'll be done incorrectly, maybe don't do that.
Yeah, let's. How and lethal about injection we not
isn't,
do that?
Lethal injection isn't perfect either, but we're not going to get on that.
No, it's anyway, not. Yeah, that's
so
the whole thing.
That's the case. That's all I got.
Yikes. You know what? If they wanted to sentence her to death, I mean, they should have just done it with arsenic. I guess eye for an eye.
I mean, that at least would be fair, right? And it would be months of very unhappy bowels, for sure.
Yeah. Let her shit herself to death. I don't know. That's how I want to go.
That's how you want to go? Okay, I'll leave that to you.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, that was insane. I hate that for us.
It was just like, yikes. I was seriously reading the story, and it was like every single time she got with somebody else, like the far-fetched stories that she came up with of what she did for a living and her education, and it's like, girl, stop. Like, no.
I'm pretty sure I've heard this on like multiple podcasts. So I think I know. I'm pretty sure I heard it on Wine and Crime because Fingers and Faces.
I looked it up to see if any of the ones that we followed did it. And I didn't think I saw any, but I might be wrong.
My Favorite Murder, maybe when we used to listen to it.
They did cover.
You think they did it? Okay. Maybe they're the ones who were the Fingers and Faces. And I'm going to mix them with Wine and Crime. Yeah. Who knows? There's no way to know. I don't.
So now I've covered one in Florida. I'll see if I can find one that's a little less covered. But that one was just so bonkers. I couldn't not.
You're welcome, Jenny.
Yeah. For visiting your state again.
When do I get my shirt?
Oh yeah, I mentioned it to her. She sent me a link, so I gotta look at it. I gotta look it up. I'll get you a shirt.
That's so funny.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. Fingers and Faces. This episode is brought to you by Fingers and Faces.
Fingers and Faces. Fingers
or new faces. We'll get that for you.
Oh, man.
Don't say anyway, it in my voice.
I know. I should be a late night somebody. I don't know. Some people hate my voice, so it's not the podcast for them.
That's it. Pure and simple. That's it.
It's over. Well, thanks.
You're welcome.
That was awful. Okay, until next time, we love you. We mean it.
Okay, bye.
The Reaper will come for us all.